Welcome to Coaching Conversations, a weekly discussion of topics related to coaching and sport of volleyball at all levels. I'm your host, John Foreman, author of the CoachingVB.com blog and co-developer of the Volleyball Coaching Wizards Project. Let's dive right in. Greetings and welcome to episode one of Coaching Conversations in its new podcast format. Today's guest with me is Mark Lebedew, who is also involved in not only the first of the original group of Coaching Conversations, but also several of the other ones on different topics. In the first one, he joined me alongside Miguel Rivera, who you will also be hearing from in the not-too-distant future in a separate podcast. The topic of this particular one is how coaches can use watching matches either in person or in video format in a way that's similar to what we would do with players watching matches to analyze other teams and learn patterns and tendencies. But in this case, more from the perspective of how can we get better at coaching, at understanding the game, and generally improving our volleyball IQ, our coaching IQ, and those sorts of things. For those who may not know him already, Mark Lebedew is a recent Australian men's national team head coach, led that program during the last quad, including not just Olympic qualifications, but World Championships, Volleyball Nations League, Asian Championships, and all of those related tournaments. He most recently has been coaching professionally in Poland, and before that was very successful as the coach of the team at Berlin in the German League, where he won three league titles, and also a bronze medal in the CEV Champions League. Mark has been an instructor in the FIVB coaching courses, and he writes a pretty well-respected blog at marklebedew.com, where he shares his thoughts on a variety of different things, some of which we'll kind of touch on in this conversation, and I'll share links in the program notes to anything that's relevant. So with that said, we'll get on with the conversation, and I hope you enjoy this kickoff to the new format. So for those of you out there wondering what exactly we're going to be talking about, a few weeks ago, as we record this, Mark and I did a discussion with my men's team on looking at other teams playing either through video or watching them live and using what they could see to develop an understanding of how the players that they're matched up play, how their team plays together. So my thought was for this, we could do something similar to that, but more from a coaching perspective in terms of how can coaches watching matches, any match, we're not even talking about watching teams that you're scouting. This is more of a kind of general coaching education thing, just to get better. How can coaches use watching other teams play to better themselves, increase their coaching IQ, so to speak? And Mark watches lots and lots and lots of video, even when he doesn't have to. What happened with your YouTube?
What happened with my YouTube was that the account was officially suspended with no information and no recourse. So I did some research and for copyright infringements, they normally give you a notice. Mm-hmm. So even though I was running a risk of IOC taking stuff down, which they had before, I had made the assumption that they would, as they had previously, give notice and just say this is not allowed or whatever. Right. They didn't say what it was for. They didn't say it was for copyright infringement. They said it was for, I forget what it
violation
was.
Violation of terms and services or something general exactly. Along those lines. Yeah. Exactly. So and you had a ton of, tons and tons of videos that you would come across. And
I was up to like 150 videos of different sorts the time that it went down.
You're rebuilding that now, sort of?
I probably won't put the matches back up again because that was a fair bit of work. And plus, well, I'd been putting matches up for 6 or 7 years, so
right,
it wasn't something that I did over the weekend that I can do over another weekend. So, one by one, I'll probably put up all of the highlight ones and the ones that are embedded in my blog posts.
Okay.
I'll likely put those ones back up and leave the rest of it. So the actual thing that bugs me the most, because I still have all of those videos, so I in a sense don't lose anything except the time that I invested in it. But the one thing that actually bugs me is that I had some fairly well curated playlists.
Okay.
That were included, that didn't only include my videos, they were all the videos on that I had found on YouTube for each of the tournaments. So,
that's a big loss.
For me, that's the thing that's been lost. So even if you lose a bunch of my videos, all that other stuff is, well, some of it, it's still there.
Yeah, it's still there somewhere. Now you just got to go find it one by one.
Well, except the ones that IOC have taken down.
Yeah.
I mean, there was because TV was playing old matches during lockdown period, Brazilian TV, for example, was playing lots of old Olympics matches and somebody was posting them straight away.
Gotcha.
And they were high quality Olympic games and I can't imagine they're still there.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's what happens. Nobody notices when it's just one person in their office posting a video from time to time. But if somebody starts abusing the system dramatically, then that tends to be a sweeping reaction.
I think that I understand that IOC want to maintain their rights to earn money from those events. And that's fine, but those games are not available on IOC platforms. So IOC platform had all of those games available, I would be more than happy to say I would pay my $10 and watch those games, but they're not there. So
And that's that can come up in a discussion on the business of volleyball or the lack of business in volleyball. Depending on your perspective on it. Anyway, but the whole point is you watch a lot of video, you've curated a lot of video, you use it on your website to make points about players should or should not be playing certain balls, things like that. And one of the early blog posts that I posted was the value to coaches of just going and watching a lot of matches from an analytic perspective. You know, it's one thing to watch it as a fan, but it's a whole different thing if you're watching it from a coaching point of view to try to understand what's going on. And that's where that's the value where it comes in. And that's the sort of stuff we want to talk about here.
Yes. It's also one of my coaching tips. I think it's something like tip 58. I don't want to be quoted on that, but watching matches is definitely one of the important tools that a coach has in improving their skills and understanding of the game.
Before we really get going, let me ask you this sort of, I guess, I don't know, tongue-in-cheek or whatever. Can you watch a match as a fan anymore, or are you always in analytic mode?
That's actually maybe a good place to start, because if I'm watching... If I'm watching as a fan, if I want to watch as a fan, which I like to do, then the best place to watch the game as a fan is in the fan areas, which means, I don't mean with fans, but I mean in the place that...
The fans normally sit, right, yeah.
Which is normally on the sidelines. Mm-hmm. So it's somewhere on the sidelines. And I find that... that's a much better view to enjoy the spectacle of the game. If I sit behind the court, then I'm watching it as a coach, because that's the coach's view. which is not incidentally the best view. It's the coach's view.
Right.
If I want to see the game but also enjoy it, then the place I actually like to sit the most is on a baseline corner, basically.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah.
Split
the difference.
Yeah, exactly. I find the view from the end of the court, I find to be an almost two-dimensional view of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And the one from the sideline, the one from the sidelines, the sort of along the net, you can see the dynamics of the game, but you don't get different parts of the the height, for example. Like from the end, the back of the court, you don't get the height and power.
Mm-hmm.
From the sideline, you get the height and power, but not some of the movement. And the back corner is pretty good.
Yeah, both the end line and the sideline lack a certain depth to them, whereas the corner lets you get a little bit more, as you say, more three-dimensional.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, at this point, I can watch from the end. I can watch from the back of the court and understand most of the time how the ball is sort of depth-wise from the net by the reactions mm-hmm. of the players. But it's a piecing together of it rather than a seeing it exactly.
Yeah. And related to that, and this is something that certainly college coaches can appreciate, is we obviously see a lot of video from recruits.
Right.
And it comes in all different varieties, depending on who's doing the videoing. If it's just some random parent who doesn't really know any better and is just recording on their phone, it's usually from it's from a fan perspective. So it's somewhere near the net on the sideline, maybe eight rows up, you know, or higher in the seats. And of course they're doing vertical video. So we lose all perspective on what's going on around their kid. So doing a lot of stuff. But a lot of it these days, because people have gotten a little more sophisticated and they're using things like Huddle with the high school team. So they put the camera off the back and record it like you would record a match. And to your point, you can see things like movement around the court quite well that way.
Yes.
You can see where the setter is getting the ball to relative to the pins,
mm-hmm.
but you can't see how far off the net that really is. You kind of have to, where does the player jump? And but obviously if you got the cameras on the side view, then you can start to see, well, is she setting the ball, you know, a meter off the net or 2 meters off the net? And, you know, all right, either that can make an adjustment off of that. And it's the same thing, you know, if you're actually in the gym working with the players and want to do replay or something with them, you know, as you've, I think, basically done more or less everywhere you've gone these last few years anyway.
Every time it's been possible.
Yeah. You know, where you put the camera kind of dictates what exactly you can look at.
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay, so we talked about where to sit. Or at least the camera angle or whatever we like. What's kind of the starting point of what you would suggest people look at?
So the first point is if you're watching the game to understand the game, the most important skill is not to watch the ball.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that took me 20 years to figure out. And it took me then another 3 years after that to get reasonably good at it. And it's a weird thing that I think should be on the first page of, it should be the first page of every coaching manual. It's one of those ones that in the, once you figure it out, it's so obvious that you're scared to say something about it out loud because it must be on the first page of the coaching book that you didn't bother reading because you thought that was the easy stuff.
Yeah.
So when you're talking to somebody to say their name at the beginning of the sentence instead of the end of the sentence, like those two things fundamental coaches' skills that should be they should be right at the top of the page of any coaching book. And both of them are
nowhere to be found.
In my coaching tools. Sorry?
I said, and you won't find them in any coaching manual.
Well, the one with the names was one where I really quietly asked a couple of phys ed sort of background people, and they looked at me like I didn't know what. Well, that's exaggerating a little bit, but it wasn't something that's taught somewhere.
Yeah,
but it's both of those things. Like once you work it out, they. And maybe good coaches work it out. Maybe it's actually the difference between good coaches and bad coaches is they work it out for themselves.
Sure. Yeah.
But anyway, the first thing is to not watch the ball, which is really difficult to do because it's as a coach, it's the thing that you tell people to do, to watch and where to look. But that's what you have to ignore. The ball, as you tell blockers, the ball has no information after the contact, before the next contact. So we can ignore it, and we should learn to ignore it. And in fact, one of the analogies that I come up with is the magic eye pictures that were really popular for a time in the 90s, I mean, 80s. The three-dimensional pictures where you see colours and shapes, but you inside this picture is a...
Some sort of image, right?
Is a three-dimensional image. Mm-hmm. If you watch more rats, it's a big part of the more rats storyline.
Okay.
But Ethan Suplee stands in front of his picture for the whole movie, trying to see the sailboat that's inside the picture.
There we go. Everybody go watch Mallrats.
But when you look at it, to see the picture, the first thing you have to do is focus on a point, and then you can see the picture. But once you've unlocked it, in a sense, you can move around and see different parts of it. Like you can move your head. Once it's there, you can move your head around and see all the different parts of it. Like like at a cinema, like when you're at a really big screen cinema, you can look at, like you can actively move your head and look at different parts of the screen.
Sure.
And the point is that, to get back to it, is that once you've got the hang of not looking at the ball, you can actually move your head around and see the movements of the players. If you're on the sideline, maybe you can only see on one side of the court, but if you're at the end line, you can see how the players are moving from both sides of the court. And that's a really key thing for understanding the game, is seeing how the players are moving before and after the ball. And when you can do that, if you can manage to do that, then that unlocks some things that you never expected to see.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a learned skill. I mean, it is definitely a learned skill. And to your point about coaches don't seem to think about it very much, we hopefully – or, you know, when we're talking, like you said, with the blockers about what are you looking at, what should you be looking at? And I remember having a conversation with my team at Exeter, you know, what are you watching on the other side? Just watching the ball. And you're like, oh, okay, that's not good. We need to fix that.
Yeah.
But then we go right back to it and like, well, we're just watching the ball all the time.
We do the same thing.
Exactly.
I can remember maybe it's 15 years ago now, the first time it crossed my mind that should I be watching the players instead of the ball? And I was an assistant at that time, and so I watched the head coach a few times in practice, and I saw him watching a ball, and I said, "Okay, he's a more experienced coach than me, so that must be the that must be it."
Right.
So then I put it on the back in the drawer for another few years before I started to revisit it.
Yeah, it's and it's kind of like meditation in that you could start it and you go and you focus on the player that you're trying to focus on or the part of the court you're trying to focus on, and then the ball will catch your attention and you'll find yourself watching the ball game. Oh, all right, I need to refocus on, you know, whatever my meditation point is or my mantra or something. Yeah. You get a training. You have to practice it. There's no way around it. You just have to intentionally practice it to make sure you can get good at it. Now, which is kind of why I brought up the point of, do you watch it as a coach or do you watch it as a fan? Because the fan's watching the ball. I mean, let's be honest. And that's kind of what you do as a fan. That's kind of the whole point.
That's actually a good point, because now even whatever position I'm sitting at, I'm still disengaging from the ball to watch what people are doing, and even TV games. So I've got to the point where even on the little screen, if I'm watching a game on my computer screen, I can disengage from the ball and and look for the players. So there's even. Yeah. There's even a particular point after the set where I go away from the ball and look for where the defenders are.
Right. Yeah. And it's one of the reasons I wrote a blog post not too long ago about the stuff that I don't like seeing in recruiting videos. And one of the things that I bring up with Libros especially, but anybody in a receiving or a defense role, where they're putting highlights of, I made this great dig or I made this perfect pass or whatever. First problem being, I don't know if those are the only 10 good ones you had the whole year and then otherwise you're shankopotamus. I don't know that. But second off, I can't see how you move when the ball is not coming to you or even when it is coming to you and how you're interacting with the rest of the play. And I need to see that from a defender, from a receiver. If you're a hitter and you go up and thump a few balls, all right, I got a pretty good idea what level you at least are capable of achieving.
Yeah.
But if all I do is I stand and watch a ball that gets served directly at you, get past perfectly a target, I haven't really learned a heck of a lot.
Well, that could be giving valuable information. If they're always exactly where the serve goes, that means they're a pretty good receiver.
Yeah, if I had a lot more than 10 reps, then I might be able to draw that conclusion.
In the defense example specifically, that's one of those things that the most spectacular plays are very often the ones where the player is in a bad position to begin with, right. And they're saving some action.
Yeah.
So I remember exactly the first day that I understood about movement in defense was when I was still a player and I was exactly 22, and there was a player in the national team that I was playing with who had a reputation as a great defender, and he was always moving in defense, like he was always moving in relation to the ball and the set, and he was diving every time and he touched every single ball, but he never defended a single ball. So all of that movement mostly took him away from where he was supposed to be in the first place, and the dive was a frantic recovery to get the ball that would have hit him on the leg if he'd actually been just standing there looking at someone in the crowd.
Right. And this comes up when you're watching, like last year, 2 years ago, Stanford has she's graduated now. Morgan Hentz was their libero, who everybody talked about in absolutely glowing terms. And I'm not about to diss her, but one of the thoughts that was going through my head, you know, is, oh, she makes all these spectacular plays and all that. I'm like, it'd be really interesting to just break her down and analyze her and see if she's having to make a lot of spectacular plays because she's not positioning herself properly, or if she's just capable of reacting a little bit more quickly than other players and getting balls that other players can't get to otherwise. And that's not something you can necessarily just watching a random college match on TV pick up.
Yeah, the male example of that is Yenia Grebennikov, the French libero, mm-hmm. who covers a lot of ground and makes a lot of spectacular plays, but I'm never 100% sure if he would get just as many or more if he covered less area. Let's put it like that.
Okay. So
if he was more stable, I think that he would control better some balls. But whether the question is, of course, whether he gets more balls up and on balance, whatever the balance is.
So. Just for the listeners' enjoyment, back in, what was it, 2015 or 2016, when you were at Berlin and you're playing Friedrichshafen in the finals,
yes.
there was a match that I got to watch in which basically the rule of thumb was if Grebennikov passed the ball, Friedrichshafen got the side out. If anybody else passed the ball, they mm-hmm. almost didn't get the side out most of the time. It was so stark in that particular match. It's just like, why yeah. would you ever serve a ball to this guy? And it didn't even have to be that he passed the ball perfectly. But if he got the ball, the first contact, that was it. They got the point.
Well, as you know, that there are structurally a lot of advantages in the libero mm-hmm. Taking the first ball.
Yep, exactly.
Which circles back to the blog post that you mentioned in the beginning about how structure breaks down when just anybody takes a ball.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we've got where you sit and we've got watch the ball, not watching the ball, learning, training yourself to not watch the ball. Okay. What's our next point of focus?
Well, we're not watching the ball. We're watching the movements of the players. So we can continue the basic idea and that you want to get further away from the ball. So the setter, for example, should be the least of your concerns if you're sort of trying to watch the whole game, so that you switch your focus pretty early onto the blockers. So what are the blockers' starting positions? How they're reacting to the position of the reception, to the approach patterns of the spikers. The spikers, if you can see the ball, because in this whole scenario, you can still see the ball. Mm-hmm. It's
in your periphery somewhere. Yeah,
it's in your periphery. And for example, if you're doing it on TV, on the laptop or even a TV. Then, you know, everything is pretty close together anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can see the ball, you can also see pretty well the attack, approaches. So really what you're looking at the most closely is the blockers, the starting position of the blockers, how they react to the reception, the origin of the set, the approaches of the spikers, and then the defenders, how they react after the set, and what happens after that is some pretty amazing things are revealed.
Yeah, well, and we've talked before, and you've mentioned this on a few occasions, and Sketch mentioned this in my discussion with him. About how at a certain level of play, especially in the men's game, things are pretty consistent. You've said, what, 80-85% of what you pull up in a scouting report for any given team is going to be about the same from team to team. One of the things that's interesting, and I had learned Lauren Bertolacci talk to my women's team from the same sort of talk that you had with the men's team.
Yeah.
And she was talking with them about the gap go play or the shoot go play or whatever your terminology is for the 31 and then the second tempo to the outside hitter. And I, you know, in going through and trying to find some footage for my players to see examples of this and what the overload concept that Lauren was trying to share with them, I got an example from USA versus Brazil on the women's side. And you can make note of what Brazil was doing in a transition situation in their block against that play, which they know is coming, mm-hmm. versus what they're doing in the receive phase of play for USA, and how this blocker is releasing or not releasing, where's the middle positioning themselves vis-a-vis the other middle, and all that sort of stuff, which, you know, is exactly the sorts of things that you're talking about here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the main thing really. And the more that I watch in that with that methodology, if you want to call it a methodology, then the more you see, and this is how I know coaches are watching the ball, because this is actually an explanation of what I am seeing, is that players have automatic reactions to the position of the ball.
Mm-hmm.
So they respond, whatever the tactic is, they respond. There's something about the way that most players, I want to say, I was going to say humans, but I actually think that it's something about the way they understand the geometry of the court, that they will automatically react to the ball in certain ways that are negative. And the obvious one is the most obvious one that I talked a lot about, is when the setter moves backwards, the reception is close to the net, but the setter moves backwards, the blocker in position four always maintains their position in relation to the setter.
So they would move toward the antenna along with
the setter, and this is position four. Mm-hmm. Then the setter moves back, position four will move back.
Right.
And then the second thing that happens is that the middle blocker, he also wants to move in that direction. And because there's a space, he will move into the empty space that he can fill. And so what you have there is a positive situation, an overload situation for the setter.
Right.
It means the middle blocker never goes all the way. Position four blocker is always behind, so the close quick has a seam.
Mm-hmm.
The pipe is open because the middle blocker has moved away from the center of the court.
Sure.
And the long ball to position four is guaranteed one-on-one.
One-on-one, yeah.
And exactly. That's all because position four reacts automatically to the movement of the ball.
And meanwhile, the most common thing, well, we could obviously look at the numbers based on level, but for probably sub-professional level players, the most common tendency is probably to set closer to position one or to position two when the setter is backing up that way, because that's the comfortable set for them.
It can be,
yeah.
but that doesn't change whatever the level, that now the first tempo is still open where they weren't open before.
Right. So. Yeah. As long as the setter, well, as long as your middle makes that run, and as long as your setter thinks something other than just put up a high ball. Yeah.
Well,
That's a training.
There are automatic tendencies of setters as well.
Mm-hmm. So, yep. So, okay.
Coaches who tell them to automatically play long, for example.
Right. Yeah. I've definitely seen that. Not a lot when you're in the lower levels, because, you know, the kids either don't think they can push the ball that far, or they just don't have the footwork developed yet to be able to do it. That's a side point. One of the interesting aspects of doing an analysis like this, watching other teams play, is the things that you can pick up about systems and how they're supposed to work in theory, like what you're taught is the reason for doing certain things. And this came up in the discussion with, with Lauren, is a lot of teams these days bunch their blockers. Presumably to have the wings help out on a quick attack with the middles, and it, oftentimes it doesn't happen at all. The underpinning theory says do this, but if you watch enough volleyball, you'll notice, the position four player is never helping out with the quick. So you can learn from those sorts of things in terms of taking reality and coaching to reality instead of coaching to what the textbook says. Yeah, and you're laughing because I know this is a point for you.
This has nothing to do with the topic, but if you actually watch the game, the things that happen in the game are not what you expect. And they're actually, I'll go out on a limb and say to a large degree, they're not even what the participants think they're doing.
I can go over that.
So spiking, for example, I'm 100% convinced that spikers don't spike in men's volleyball. They don't spike the way that you think they spike.
Okay. Well, for people who haven't watched nearly as much men's volleyball as you have, explain what you mean by that.
Well, the way that spikers are taught to spike is to see the block and to spike around the block.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think that women's volleyball
is probably more in that direction.
Why the libero ends up defending so many balls in women's volleyball.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a double block and the spiker sees the block and spikes past the block, and the libero camps past the block. And there's some other things, but that's what I suspect happens there. With men's volleyball, they choose or they predetermine their attack before and at varying times before the attack.
Mm-hmm.
So opposites can predetermine their attack, especially from back row, from position one. They will predetermine their general attack direction before the setter contacts the ball.
Yep.
And that's one thing. A lot of the time players are not spiking at the court. So in men's volleyball, they're not even thinking about the court. So we spend hours charting with a piece of paper. Maybe we don't do it exactly anymore, but we have a piece of paper and we draw lines on the piece of paper at the directions. But the reality is that the spikers are not spiking at parts of the court. They're spiking at parts of the block or where they expect the block to be, which is a different thing again. So I didn't personally, but my assistant had a conversation with a player who said they like playing at home better than away, because when they played at home, they knew the point of the advertising to aim for, that the block would end up getting into, so that the block would touch it on the way out.
See, you bringing that up is actually really interesting, because I've been doing research on home advantage in volleyball, which is, generally speaking, from the research I've seen on other sports, it's about the smallest of the sports. Rugby, a Spanish group did like 10 different sports, and rugby was like way on the top. It was like 67% of the time the home team won, whereas in volleyball it was like 55-56%. And the numbers that I've run backs that up across different leagues, different countries, all that. It's pretty much on that end. And for me, part of the reason is that because we're playing multiple sets as opposed to one time period of a game, like a rugby match would be, or basketball or soccer or anything, the better team is going to tend to win in that sort of structure. just generally speaking. But there is still some advantage. You know, we can statistically show there is still some home advantage. And there's always the theories about, well, why is that? And one researcher I talked to recently expressed the view that at least in part it's the subjective nature of the officials making calls. You know, like in soccer, because that was his specialty, you know, whether it's a tackle or whether it's a foul, or not a foul, penalty, not a penalty. Things that in that sport tend to be quite influential, because if you call a penalty, that's they only score a small number of points in a game. And if you call a penalty, that's going to represent a large portion. Yeah. In volleyball, there's way more points and there are way fewer influential subjective calls. I think I ran some numbers on NCAA stuff and it was like 3% of points are the result of ball handling errors, which is really the only subjective, like truly subjective aspect of the game. That was the other thing. Technically, that's not subjective. That's objective. But at the speed of it is subject to influence. I would agree with you on that. But now you're bringing it up. Well, okay, if you're at home and you've got a hitter who can target a certain spot on his court, but he can't do it on another court, that's another area where home advantage can come in. And now having just gone on that digression, I forgot what I was going to be, what I wanted to bring up. To the point about, I agree with you on women not attacking the block nearly as frequently as the men do, especially.
Which they should, because a block in women's volleyball is worse.
Yes. Yes. The other thing I was going to say is I'm going to agree with you in terms of attackers predetermining where they're going to go. When that happens, obviously what happens with a set influences things in the end result. But when that predetermination happens probably varies a little bit based on level of play. Like a high school kid might decide before the play even starts that they're going to hit the ball cross court and that's just going to be it. Whereas a higher level player will determine a little bit later, you know, maybe after the ball's actually been served, they're gonna attack the ball line in this situation or in a certain body position.
Better players, they reduce their options earlier. That I'm 100% sure of. So the junior kid who gets told that he has to be able to hit in every direction is going up there thinking that I'm ready to hit in every direction. But the best spikers can hit in every direction, but they can't hit in every direction off one single ball.
Right.
So they don't wait for the ball. They can't hit from line to 3-meter line cross court off every single set.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't try. So they have two or three variations of the ball is here and here and here, and that's what they work with. And they work with the block.
Right.
And sometimes they can predetermine. Really, the opposite from position one is a really big one. And you can see it a lot with a lot of guys that because the basic tactic for men's volleyball is that when the setter is when the setter is front row, position four will stay close to the setter wherever he goes.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't set so much to position one, the theory goes, it's not true, and the ball is a little bit slower, which it is because it's off the net.
Right.
So when position four stays close to the setter, the opposite will hit line because he knows that the position four can't close the line no matter what he does.
Right.
And you will see there are some really good blockers who actually will dive to the line and get blocks because, you know, they cover 5 meters of the court. So position four blockers, they can do some amazing stuff. And they're, in a sense, they're predetermining their action as well.
Right. And that situation is one of those ones where what I was talking about before about the wing blocker pinching in, and are they actually doing what they're nominally pinched in to do? Are they actually effectively defending against the center being able to attack a ball? Are they actually helping out with the quick blocking the quick attack. Now, at a certain level, yes. But where does that come into play? And I mean, honestly, most of the time where I've seen a position four blocker assigned to try to take away the attack of the center, they're not effective. They're not doing it either because they're not anticipating it, or they just don't get up on time.
Yeah, but how many setters actually tip enough that you would dedicate a blocker to it? If there's no back row attack, I guess so.
Well, but even then, it's still you still ask the same question. You know, that's one of those things. Well, if there's no position one attacker, or there's no position two attacker, then pull the block over and they're going to cover the center. Well, what if the center is? I mean, how often? Even if you have a good attacking center, how often do they actually attack the ball?
Yeah, maybe 6% of the time.
Yeah, and that's on passes of sufficient quality.
But that's a general tendency of blockers is to hedge.
Yeah.
Blockers hate to predetermine their actions. They're the opposite. So they can sometimes jump with the first tempo, but the rest of the time they're hedging. They don't want to go too early, even on high balls. And one of the things when I'm watching, not the ball, but the blockers, is how terrible people are at blocking high balls. How late they move, how badly positioned they are, how much they move their hands. And I know that men's volleyballers focus on triple blocking, mm-hmm. and they're horrendous at it.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, my definition of quality triple block is different from everybody else's, which is also possible.
Well, and that one of the things that I thought of while you were saying that is that the reason why you don't actually see a lot of true commit blocking in the men's game? You might have positional commitment, but do the blockers actually jump in anticipation of the set in terms of a quick attack?
Really good ones do. Really good ones and really bad ones. So the really good ones are prepared to take the risk. So, but below the really best level, they're still hedging. So with the Australian guys, they could never commit properly. Even when they committed, they were always late. So even on the commit, they were hedging.
Right.
But and on high balls and fast balls, they do it too.
Yep.
Really bad blockers will commit because they convince themselves that they're doing something. So it's I'm committing, so I'm stopping the middle.
Okay. All right, we're running close on time. So
on time and far from the topic.
Right. It's all good. That's why we call them conversations, because it gives us a bit of freedom. So just recapping. So the first thing we said is pick your place. Yeah, where you sit. Pick where you sit. Second thing we said was don't focus on the ball. Focus on something else, whatever it happens to be. Movement of the players is generally speaking.
Yep.
And third thing is pay attention to the movement of the blockers and the defenders once the ball is in play. Anything we've missed? Any other points that you'd toss out there?
Couple of extra points that I'll make about the way you sit is to sit in different points, is to actually actively go to different places to watch the game. Mm-hmm. Because from different places, you see different things.
Yeah.
And I had a big, I don't want to say the word that I can't think of right now, so I can't say it.
Disagreement?
No.
The opposite.
Okay.
Light bulb. Well, that would light be agreement. Moment. Oh, okay, gotcha.
One time where by accident I was sitting along the net. And sitting along the net, you can see the the position of the blockers, hands, how they penetrate, or in this case, not penetrate.
Right.
So don't get stuck in one position. And this is actually a general coaching thing too, is coaches want to get to that end place, but you don't watch a match from that position. You actually have to watch the match from close to the court on the side, on near the 3 meter line, somewhere along there. So you actually should, in your practice, watching the match from that position, because that's the one that you have to use.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. When in the second one about watching not the ball is that you can choose to watch whatever you want. So you can choose to for 5 minutes that you only watch the setter. So I said that you don't have to watch the setter because the setter has no information. That's true in one sense. So I watch the block and the defense, but you can also choose to watch the setter because the setter does a lot of things. You can watch how they move their body. When you watch setters really closely, they have really good setters have a lot of fairly subtle general movements, fairly subtle movements that are hard to pick up if you're just watching broadly. But all of them can make the blocker hesitate. So it's actually really fun to watch the setter really, really closely. So those are the two things. And what was the third? The third point was about
focusing on the block and defense.
Okay, so combination of third.
There you go. All right.
Yeah.
We can wrap it up there.
Thanks for listening. Check out the show notes on the website, coachingbb.com, for links and further information about this episode. You'll also be able to find the complete back catalog of prior coaching conversations. While you're there, you can sign up for my mailing list. Members find out in advance what conversations I'll be doing next and can submit questions if they like. If you'd like to support this podcast, go to patreon.com/coachingbb. Patrons get early access to every episode, as well as other special benefits along the way. I'm always interested in hearing what you think about coaching conversations and ideas you might have of topics and or guests for future episodes. You can send them to me at john@coachingbb.com, tweet them to @coachingbb, or hit me up on my Facebook page, Coaching Volleyball. All the best until next time.